This is WGTDHD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Guida Brown, former executive director of the Hope Council, Dr. Steve Brown, retired professor of educational leadership and school law, Dr. Karen Sconsert, chair of the education department and associate professor at Carthage College, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, professor of communications at UW Parkside, and Stephanie Skilba, Vice President for Community and Government Relations at Gateway Technical College. And now, here's today's moderator for Education Matters.
And good morning and welcome to this edition of Education Matters here on WGTDHD, serving Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. I'm Steve Brown, your host this morning, and I'm very pleased to have as my guest Dr. Tracy Holloway, and she is the 2017 through 2021 Gaylord Nelson, our former U.S. Senator here in Wisconsin, a distinguished professor at the University of Wisconsin. And we'll talk about her work in environmental studies and atmospheric and ocean sciences. Also, we'll talk about a group called Science Moms, a very interesting organization here in Wisconsin. And we'll talk about a number of things. Dr. Holloway, welcome to Education Matters.
Thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Before we start, give us a bit of your background. I always like to start with that, and I always have an interesting closing question at the end about your life growing up with regards to teachers that you had in your life. But anyway, give us some background of yourself, and we'll take it from there.
Great. Well, I grew up outside of Chicago, and I am now a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I've been here for 20 years, and my research deals mainly with air quality, the chemicals in the air that we breathe in, that come from lots of sources, both human sources and natural sources. And the same chemicals that, the same sources of pollutants that we already control for public health are also factors in affecting climate. And so that's how I got pulled into the Science Moms program, which was launched in 2020. But at Wisconsin, I teach, I work with community members, and I do research. And my research mainly relates to issues that connect the air, energy systems, and public health. So this idea of being kind of at this interface is really exciting. And I lead a team for NASA to make satellite data more relevant to public health and air quality as well.
You know, in doing a little bit of research on yourself, on you, you obviously did not get started in climate science until late in college. And I'm just quoting this, says that you thought that you would pursue law or business after graduating with an applied mathematics degree. But then you had a summer job at NASA. Was that in Florida or was that in Texas, in Houston?
That was in Houston, Texas. You're exactly right. My dad's a lawyer and my mom is an accountant. And, you know, I thought that applied math would be a very practical skill, knowing how to work with numbers, that I could do a lot of things. I'd get a job. And so the summer before my senior year of college, I knew I should get a summer job someplace, but I had no idea what I was qualified for. So I applied everywhere. I applied to the Northern Trust Bank of Chicago. I applied to the FBI in Washington, D.C. I applied to NASA. To me, you know, they were all these far off opportunities. And I was invited to go work at the Johnson Space Flight Center that summer. And that was the first time that I really saw that being a scientist is a job, and it's a career that is really exciting. You go to work and answer problems and try to figure out these mysteries of the planet or the universe. And that was the first time that I really thought of this as a career path. And I came back from that summer working at NASA and began to look into PhD programs, because I had not really known people who had a PhD when I was growing up. But I learned that summer that most of the scientists at NASA had PhDs, and a lot of the other students were talking about applying for graduate school. So I kind of came back with my eyes open to that as something that I'd look into as well.
So when you were at NASA and having been to the Johnson Space Center in Houston a number of times, what did you do that summer? You were what, a junior or a senior at that time?
I had just finished my junior year. I was going into my senior year. And actually, when they called me, they said there were two projects that were available for me to choose from. And they described them both, but I didn't really understand exactly what the choice was. You know, there was a lot of terminology that I didn't know. And finally, they boiled it down to a question. One is about Earth and one is about Venus. Which planet do you like better, Earth or Venus? And I thought, well, between those two, I know Earth a lot better. I live here. And so, you know, I chose the project that was looking at the radiation belts around the Earth. There's these naturally occurring radiation called the Van Allen radiation belts. Mm-hmm. And actually, these belts are far enough up that normally when we used to have a shuttle program, the space shuttle would fly above the Earth but below the radiation belts. But actually, right over the South Atlantic Ocean, the radiation belts dipped a little bit closer to Earth. Mm. So that only over the South Atlantic, when the space shuttle flew through, it was exposed to higher levels of radiation. And this was really important because, for example, when they would do spacewalks, when the astronauts would leave the space shuttle and walk around in space, they never wanted to do that over the South Atlantic, because that would expose the astronauts to higher levels of radiation. So there was a lot of interest in understanding the location of this kind of bulge of high radiation over the South Atlantic. And my research project was analyzing measurement data and computer model data of where this South Atlantic anomaly, as it was called, was, and how it was sort of slowly drifting.
You know, you talk about astronomy, and it was just last week that five planets were lined up around the moon, which was fascinating. And I live here in Western Kenosha County, so there aren't a lot of external lighting. I was able to see that. By the way, when you were at NASA, did you at any time, especially as you were already thinking about changing your direction from business or law, ever think about applying for a full-time job at NASA?
Well, I certainly did. But one thing I realized is that most of the people who I was meeting who worked at NASA had gone to graduate school first. So I was seeing that actually, if I wanted to work at NASA, which I thought would be very cool, one of the pathways to get there would be to go to graduate school.
Sure.
And actually, when I applied to graduate school, like just like going applying to college, I looked at a few different programs and I applied to different places. And the program that I ended up going to was actually working at a research lab very similar to a NASA lab, except it was part of NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Mm-hmm. And just like NASA has labs in Florida and Houston and other places, NOAA has labs in different parts of the country. And in New Jersey, they have a lab called the Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory. And this is really one of the premier labs for developing computer models of the atmosphere and ocean in the world. Dr. Suki Manabe won the Nobel Prize in Physics last year, and he was at that laboratory and one of the pioneers in climate modeling. And so it was really an exciting place to go to graduate school and had a lot of the same excitement that I loved when I was at NASA in Houston, because you're at this facility surrounded by these expert researchers who are working together as a team to tackle these huge problems that no one scientist could handle on their own. And I think that this idea of thinking of science as a team-based activity, that's something that really appealed to me when I was an undergraduate. And it's something I loved about the graduate program at the NOAA lab. And it's really something that, I keep moving in my work at the UW, really trying to think of this as, we're a team, and how can we do something together that we couldn't do as individuals?
Mm-hmm. And by the way, having been on the campus at Princeton in New Jersey and aware of the NOAA lab there, which I did not get a chance to go to, but, one of the things, before we talk about Science Moms, because it's a really neat program, I wanted to ask you something. With regards to a lot of research that's been done for 30 or 40 years, if not more, about why young ladies don't go into science and mathematics. And now we talk about STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. But a study done by the AAUW, the American Association of University Women, back in 2021, they said that the workforce in STEM across the country, only 28% are women. As you look at what you have done, as you look at why you did what you did and continue to do that, why do you think, and I know this is a wonderful research study that someone might be listening to do a doctoral study at UW-Madison or anywhere, why is it that there's still the issue of young ladies going into any of these areas of STEM?
Yeah, so I think this is a huge issue and one that I've thought about for a long time, because when I was a student, I just wanted to do what I thought would make me happy. And, every young person is trying to figure out where do they fit in the world? What jobs, what majors are the right fit for them? And, they're looking to the people they know in their lives and, thinking about what they know about what they want their own future to be like. And so when I was going through this process, I just thought, I'm trying to figure out what's best for me, Tracy, as I chart my path. But now, once I got a little bit further in, I started to see that I was experiencing some patterns that were very common to other people and other women. And the more I started looking around, I could see some of the things I was feeling weren't just me. They were actually systematic messages that a lot of young women are getting. And, for example, I remember when I was an undergraduate and decided to major in applied math, there was one friend of mine, and he was meaning to make a compliment, but he said, Tracy, you're so nice, you're good with people. Why are you majoring in applied math? Like, that's not using your people skills. And, you know, he meant it totally as a compliment. But luckily, I was already far enough along that I wasn't going to change my major at that point. Okay. But I think sometimes these little, this little sort of messages that if you're good with people, then you shouldn't do science or you shouldn't do math. And in some sense, even mental model that, you know, a scientist is sort of toils all by themselves in, you know, in a laboratory somewhere late at night. I think, you know, really, most of the science that I've seen has been more of a team-based collaborative approach. And that's what definitely drew me into science. Mm-hmm. And so to me, the good thing is that, like, there's so many different ways to do science. And one of the messages that I've been trying to promote over my career is that really science can be for anyone, and not to, you know, swap out in one way or another, just as a self, you know, because of messages that you may have received when you were a 12-year-old. But there are also systematic issues. And a lot of research has shown, you know, systematic biases against certain communities, whether they're it's by gender or by race or by background. And, you know, I think once I got far enough into science to see the patterns and that it wasn't just this one person's experience or somebody else's, then I started thinking about how can we change those structures to make it more welcoming, more inclusive, more fair. And I think what's really exciting is that across the scientific and engineering disciplines, there's a huge emphasis on trying to make these fields more welcoming for everybody. And, you know, one article that was written, you know, a number of years ago about women in science had the tagline, "A mountain of molehills." And I think that's also a nice way to think about it, that there's not just one big thing that's keeping women or any other group out of science and STEM fields, but that sometimes these little things, like the comment about the social skills, if you have enough of those little messages and little barriers, they can also have a big impact.
Sure. And by the way, that AAUW study, one of the things that they also mentioned, that STEM fields are often viewed as masculine, and teachers and parents often underestimate young ladies' math abilities starting at a very early age, even oftentimes as early as preschool. And that reflects directly on what you were just saying, that STEM continues to be male-dominated. And I'll just make a side comment, and that is, you know, we need more people. We need school districts. I serve on a school board in Western Kenosha County. You know, it's a KA district, but we feed into two wonderful high schools, Central High School and Wilmont High School. And I'm always talking at school board meetings and when I'm out in the community about the importance of making sure that we let every student, regardless of who they are, the color of their skin, their gender, whatever, that any field is something that they can pursue. Do you see any big changes happening, let's say in the next 5 years, in your crystal ball, where that number is going to increase, get better, and how might you help that along? I know that's a long, drawn out question.
No, it's a great question. And, you know, I think that studies have shown that, you know, within a community, you need to have at least 30% of an underrepresented group before they stop feeling like they're the outsiders. And so I think one issue is building, you know, moving the needle so that a group that might be 10% moves up to 20%, moves up to 30%, so that it becomes a more equitable, like, representative set of professors leading a department, or teachers in a school, or scientists who are interviewed for TV. We want that when kids look at the role models around them, that they see somebody that they can relate to. Maybe not everybody, but that they could see enough people they can relate to that it doesn't seem like a weird idea to go into STEM. Mm-hmm. Another thing, though, is beyond the role models is actually having the personal mentors. And I think, you know, one of the things that I found at the University of Wisconsin is that, you know, I love to work with undergraduate students. I have graduate students, of course, but I also love to work with undergraduates in my research lab. And I have an open door policy. Basically, if a student has taken my class and wants to do research with me, I welcome them in, as long as I don't have too many in any one year. But actually my research group is very mostly women. And so I didn't seek them out. I didn't preferentially hire them. I just welcome whoever wants to work with me. And I think just as human nature goes, it has happened that that it is a lot of young women. And now many of these women who came from Wisconsin are going off and getting PhDs or amazing jobs. They're off now being professors at different universities or senior researchers and leading their own groups. And so it's so exciting to see how these, you know, the students of today, you snap your fingers and they're off making change in the world and being mentors themselves. So I just, you know, every morning I really am thankful to be a faculty here, and I love Wisconsin, just to be here. And I think the students who we get to serve are so amazing. And so, you know, it's great to have them stay right here in the state and keep their expertise in-house. It's also exciting when they are off and making change all around the world. So I think, you know, I guess I feel like the mentors and the role models are going to make change.
Mm-hmm. Let's shift a bit and talk about Science Moms. Maybe if you could give a quick overview of the organization, how it got started, how you got involved with it. I know you were involved with it from the beginning, I believe. But just what Science Moms is all about, and then maybe we can drill down into some of the actual projects that Science Moms is involved in.
Yeah, so Science Moms is an outreach initiative that is really trying to make climate science, climate solutions, climate information accessible to moms. And of course, not just moms, all parents, anyone can go to the website sciencemoms.com. But moms were identified in part because there was no outreach on climate that was addressing this huge segment of the population who are making a lot of decisions about the future, their kids. So when the Science Moms Initiative took shape, there was an effort to bring in scientists who are also moms, like me. I have two boys here in Madison. And think about how can we take a lot of complex information and make it accessible and actionable by these busy people who care about the issue but don't have time to necessarily sit down and read a textbook. Mm-hmm. And so the team has really put together on social media, recommending books for kids, but also putting together kind of key messages Like right now, we're in the middle of an initiative called Cleanversations, trying
Mm-hmm.
to talk about clean energy and the idea that as we move toward clean energy for climate, that's also making our kids healthier because it's impacting the air we breathe. And for example, swapping out a diesel school bus for an electric school bus means that our kids don't have to breathe the exhaust fumes from the bus. And, you know, we're also then tackling energy and climate issues at the same time.
You know, in reading on the website, there were some quotes from a few newspapers and publications, actually many of them from around the country. The Philadelphia Inquirer saying that climate change is a parenting issue. As you were just talking, what kinds of things do you say to your own children with regards to climate change? I forget the ages of your kids, but you know, how do you bring it down to their level and yet still make it relevant, still make it important, still make it something that is meaningful and most importantly, that they will remember?
Yeah, so I have two boys. One is 13 and one is about to turn 3. So I talk to them in very different ways, as you can imagine. But I think the one thing that I am always consistent about is, you know, having a very positive outlook on the future. Because, you know, I want to empower my kids, I want to empower my students to think of these challenges as solvable problems and to feel empowered themselves to make the world a better place as they in the now, but also as they get older. But making the world a better place, in my opinion, does not mean saying, okay, good luck solving that. That's going to be your problem. Because I also want them to know that, like, we're the grown-ups. You know, we're here. We want to make sure that they have food on the table at dinner. And if there's a problem when it comes to the climate, I want to do my best to be solving that, too. So, you know, not burdening them with these huge problems, but empowering them that they're solvable and making them know that I'm doing my best as their mom to take action that can benefit their future. And to me, that's the powerful thing, just for them to know that, like, whatever they hear on the news, I'm their mom and I'm trying to fix the problem.
Mm-hmm. In April, it's called the first Earth Month since the passing of major federal initiatives available to parents and local governments for the transition to clean energy. If you could tell me about that project and why that's important, and then how will that get extended beyond April, you know, into May, June, September, into 2024? How does all this fit together?
Yeah, so over the past few months, the U.S. government has passed a series of policies on clean energy. And really, it's the biggest investment in clean energy that's ever occurred. So there's all sorts of tax breaks and incentives that can help individual families, individual homeowners make the swap to clean investments. And that might be an electric car, or that might mean an electric heat pump to replace an old furnace. It also has, the government has incentives, billions of dollars, to support infrastructure investments, just like the clean school buses, the clean electric school buses that I was mentioning earlier. So, You know, this is one of these things, like we don't buy a car every day. We don't replace our home heating every day. These are rare decisions, hopefully ones that only occur, few and far between. But when we make those decisions, that's affecting, our own personal emissions and, the community, the nation, and the world for, the next 10 or 20 years. So with these incentives from the government, there's actually an amazing opportunity to save money on these clean swap out opportunity these to save money on swapping dirtier appliances, dirtier cars for cleaner alternatives.
If you were appearing before a school board and you had 2 minutes or a minute and 30 seconds just to talk about how you actually do these things, the process of talking to parents, how that translates into parents talking to their own children, and also the impact on communities. What kinds of bullet points would you focus in on?
Well, I always like to emphasize solutions because, these are complex, big problems, but most people just want to know, okay, what can we do about it? And I think that the solutions boil down to, first, when there are investments to be made, to take into account where the energy is coming from, what are the cleaner solutions? And this might be an energy efficient refrigerator. It might be electric school buses instead of diesel school buses. It might be investing in solar electricity versus extending the life of an older coal-fired power plant. But when decisions have to come up, just to make them in a way that's moving us toward a clean energy future. And really, just talking about them is powerful in itself because research has shown that, Americans care about climate change. Moms care about climate change and the environment. I mean, we care about the future of our kids, and this is a part of the, this is a huge part of the world that they'll be living in. But even though people care about it, they don't talk about it. And I think one of the reasons we don't talk about it is because it can be so charged, so controversial. And that's again where I feel like just talking about the solutions, we have decisions to make. Should we buy a car that is an electric car or a hybrid car or an internal combustion car? These are choices, and I think if we, talk about why we might make these decisions, it's not so much that we have to fight about, politics. It's about just raising awareness and realizing that these are solvable problems.
You mentioned politics, and as I always like to say to people, when it comes down to it, everything is political. We just had, elections across the state. A number of referenda did not pass, some did pass. Changes on the state Supreme Court. I mean, everything is political. How do you, and I want to try to word this carefully, how do you as a professor at a state university, when you're talking to organizations, when you're talking about issues and things related to science moms, how do you stay away from the political side, even though people are going to bring it up anyway?
Yeah, that's a good question. First, Science Moms is a nonpartisan organization, and I would not have joined if it was partisan, because I really try to share the truth and, answer questions directly and, listen to all sides of an issue. So, I grew up as a middle child. I really like working with different perspectives on an issue. And, you know, in my classes at the university, I'll invite, you know, sometimes, you know, attorneys or spokespeople or whatever for very different perspectives. And oftentimes, you know, people who might know each other but be on different sides of a lawsuit. So I really think it's important for our students to hear from different perspectives why different groups support action, why different groups might dispute whether actions are necessary. Because we're not trying to train Democrats or Republicans, we're trying to train thinkers and problem solvers. And I think there's no way to solve a problem if you can't listen to the other side and think it through. And from my perspective, my goal is to make sure that the best available science can get connected with the complex decisions that we're making every day.
As you look at the future of science moms, what kinds of areas or areas of focus do you see the organization moving into that maybe you and other members of the organization and on the board of directors have talked about, but you haven't moved there yet?
Well, it's a really good question, and I'm not sure, you know, what's coming next. I was really enthusiastic that this current outreach effort is focused on the win-win strategies of how clean energy is good for the climate and good for public health, because this is something that I work on very much in my own research. I think that for a long time, we've dealt with chemicals like ozone smog, which is a huge issue along the shoreline of Wisconsin, through the DNR. And then we've talked about, you know, energy and carbon emissions through like the Public Service Commission and kind of a different set of conversations on these two issues, even though really anything we change around energy affects the air we breathe, and anything we're doing to make the air we breathe cleaner is affecting energy. So, you know, I've been trying to bring these topics together for a long time. And I've been enthusiastic that the Science Moms, you know, outreach campaign focused on these federal policies to make it cheaper to make clean energy investments have been emphasizing what these, the good that these can do for public health, for our kids' health, kind of the win-win opportunities. So I've been excited that, you know, this time around, the Science Moms messaging is very much in line with what I do with my research. But what's coming next, you know, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Before I ask my last question, another question I always like to ask is there any question that I have not asked that I should have that you would like to share with our audience?
That's a great question, because there's so much we could talk about, Steve. And, you know, maybe one thing I'll say just as kind of a cool bit of Wisconsin information is that the whole idea of seeing the atmosphere with satellites was started right here in Wisconsin. So we're often considered the birthplace of satellite meteorology. And when we use satellites to look at the Earth, it helps us predict the weather better, but we can also We can also see chemicals in the air that we can't even see with our eyes. So we can see roadways and power plants and airports, and we can also track where they're going down and where they're going up all around the world. So I think a lot of these sort of science advances, even what's happening with NASA and air pollution and how they fit together, really tie back to legacies and strengths here in Wisconsin going back to the 1960s.
Mm-hmm. And my last question, somewhat of a personal question. You said you grew up in the Chicagoland area. Where did you go to public school?
I went to New Trier High School, north of Chicago.
I know it well. I supervised many. When I taught at Northeastern Illinois University, I had a number of teachers who were in our master's program in school administration. Either at New Trier or whichever elementary district or middle school district you were living in or you attended, was there one teacher who had a real incredible impact on you for enlightening you on whatever topic or just something that you will always remember?
There are so many. I had great teachers really from preschool all the way on up. But one I remember especially was my third grade teacher, because she was really trying to connect creativity with scientific problem solving. I remember she had us one day make up what we thought would be the recipe for bread. And then the next day she brought in all the crazy ingredients that these third graders had written and had us make up the bread that we had imagined the day before. And I think this idea of creativity and science going together is something that was not a consistent thread. In fact, that's really why I didn't love science in high school, because sometimes it felt like, you know, you were doing steps A, B, and C, and if you did them right, you got the right answer, and if you did them wrong, you got the wrong answer. But actually, the more I've gotten into science, it's much more like the third grade experience of being creative and thinking about how different pieces could fit together. And maybe they fit together in a way that is consistent with what we already know, but maybe they fit together in a way that helps us see things a little differently. So I think my third grade teacher, Mrs. Wygand, was really, really memorable as connecting creativity and science in a way that I really still sort of think back to pretty regularly now.
Sure. And which school was that?
That was at Greeley School in Winnetka, Illinois.
Okay, I know that area well. Dr. Tracy Holloway, I want to thank you so much for being my guest this morning here on Education Matters and talking about so many relevant points of interest that we all need to always be thinking about. And hopefully we can have you as a guest again in the future. And you're certainly welcome to come down here to Western Kenosha County and